tonight at Ezekiel 23, I'm, for sake of time, I'm having to just kind of skip over chapters 21 and 22. Just so much here in the book of Ezekiel. I don't think those two chapters are difficult. I think it's pretty self-evident what's being talked about. Chapter 21, that imagery of God wielding his sword. And he's going to bring his sword in judgment upon his people. And then chapter 21, just delineating the various kinds of sins of the nation. Very similar to some of the earlier oracles that Ezekiel has given. But I feel like we need to devote all of our class time to chapter 23. This, I think, is one of the most powerful of all of the oracles that Ezekiel gives. It's certainly the most graphic. And I hope that everyone has been able to read over this. It is a tremendously powerful oracle using the imagery of harlotry that we've seen Ezekiel earlier give back in chapter 16 and his oracle there where the nation had played the harlot. Similar imagery, though really emphasizing some different aspects of that in a very graphic way. And so we want to look at this just powerful, powerful oracle tonight. It starts out here in chapter 23, "The word of the Lord came to me again, saying, Son of man, there were two women, the daughters of one mother, and they played the harlot in Egypt. They played the harlot in their youth. There their breasts were pressed, and there their virgin bosom was handled. Their names were Aholah, the elder, and Aholibah, her sister. And they became mine, and they bore sons and daughters. And as for their names, Samaria is Aholah, and Jerusalem is Aholibah." Once again, you have Ezekiel give a parable that really is an allegory. It's that kind of a parable. And I want us just to look at these introductory verses here, and then we'll just go ahead and read from the biblical text as we go on through. But I want to just notice some things here as he's allegorizing the nation of Israel. And of course, at the time when Ezekiel is prophesying, it's of course been a divided nation. And ever since 930 BC, they have been a nation split in two. And so this is the reason why in this allegorical representation, he talks about two sisters, and they are the daughters of one mother. And so he's making it very clear that these are two sisters that are representing the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah, or specifically to refer to the capitals of those two respective kingdoms. He talks about Aholah, the elder sister. She stands for Samaria. And then Aholibah, the younger sister, she stands for the city of Jerusalem. It's a little difficult to really pinpoint the exact significance of these two names that are given. Aholah and Aholibah, they both are terms in Hebrew that refer to a tent. Aholah literally means her tent. Some people think that it is getting at the idea of a sacred tent or a shrine that might be set up to house various idols for the worship of various gods. And maybe that's the point here. Maybe it's sort of a way of talking about the idolatry in Samaria and the idolatry also that he'll talk about in Jerusalem. We don't know that for sure, but just as far as the name Aholah, that means her tent. And then the related name Aholibah, that means a tent is in her. So some people, you know, he makes it clear that's the name for Jerusalem, the capital of the southern kingdom. So, you know, people have suggested, well, maybe that's kind of a reference to the idea of the tabernacle of God being brought into Jerusalem. And so in that city, the tent of God was there. You know, maybe, but we just really aren't quite sure of the significance of those names. But I think the overall point of this is just real clear. Here is a parable or an allegory that is describing the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom as two women whom God had married, so to speak, in Egypt when he had brought them out of Egypt, and they'd had a very checkered past in Egypt. In fact, he says in verse 3, they played the harlot in Egypt. They played the harlot in their youth. There their breasts were pressed, and there their virgin bosom was handled. And that just introduces you to the very explicit language he's going to use as he describes the unfaithfulness to Yahweh of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, describing it as adultery, describing it as a wife who then plays the harlot. And of course, as he goes on through, he's going to describe this in a very graphic way. But that's the introduction to all of this. Now, I want to start reading these verses and really get into some of these specific nuances that he's trying to emphasize about the sins of the nation. But before I go on to that, any comment about just these introductory verses? All right, let's start reading here with verse 5. And Aholah played the harlot while she was mine, and she lusted after her lovers, after the Assyrians, her neighbors, who were clothed in purple, governors and officials, all of them desirable young men, horsemen riding on horses. And she bestowed her harlotries on them, all of whom were the choicest men of Assyria. And with all whom she lusted after, with all their idols, she defiled herself. And she did not forsake her harlotries from the time in Egypt, for in her youth men had lain with her, and they handled her virgin bosom and poured out their lust on her. Therefore I gave her into the hand of her lovers, into the hand of the Assyrians, after whom she lusted. They uncovered her nakedness. They took her sons and her daughters, but they slew her with the sword. Thus she became a byword among women, and they executed judgments on her. All right, now let's just talk about this a little bit. I want to make sure people really appreciate the imagery that is being used here. First of all, the whole business of the past in Egypt. I mean, this really is imagery of a young girl who was sexually active and lustful and promiscuous from her youth on. And then she gets married, in this case to Yahweh, and now she just continues her wicked ways and she plays the harlot and with all sorts of lovers. That's the overall imagery here. And of course, one part of that imagery is to emphasize the idolatry of the Israelite people that really went back to Egypt. You know, we oftentimes talk about why did the Israelites, when God brought them out of Egyptian bondage and they saw these great miracles against the Egyptians and the Red Sea and all that, why is it that they just so quickly... they build the golden calf, and it just seems like so quickly they revert into paganism. What's the reason for that? Well, they've been pagan in Egypt. I mean, and that's the point of God's language here. They had committed idolatry in Egypt, and so using that metaphorical language, they were then sexually promiscuous, going out after all these other gods rather than the gods, God of their father, rather than Yahweh, the true God of their people. And so now the point is that now that you've got these two sisters, and the older sister has grown up, that's the northern kingdom, Samaria, and that northern kingdom of Israel, they're idolatrous too. But it's more than just the idolatry. What's he getting at when he talks about how she played the harlot and she went after her lovers and these mighty men and all the warriors, what's he trying to get at there, aside from the idolatry? Anybody have a thought on that, Pat? Or Phil, I mean?
Spiritual adultery.
Well, I mean, certainly, yeah, that's at the base of that. But look at some of these references here. I mean, look at how he describes this. Like, again, verse 5, she lusted after her lovers, after the Assyrians, her neighbors, who were clothed in purple, governors and officials, all of them desirable young men, horsemen riding on horses. Okay, that's not idolatry. That didn't talk about idols. What specifically is he alluding to about the Assyrians that was so appealing to the northern kingdom? Their wealth and their power and their military might. Okay? That's really what this chapter is especially emphasizing. I mean, yes, it's idolatry, but it's more than that, because it's talking about how she engaged these idolatrous nations in international treaties and wanted to make covenants with these nations and wanted them to make covenants with Israel so that they could share and all that wealth. In other words, this is Israel trying to be like the nations round about. Instead of being content with Yahweh and with this culture that Yahweh had set up with a Mosaic law, and rather than being content with Yahweh's protection, they are looking at the surrounding nations and they're saying, they have what we want. They have the wealth, they have the power, they have the military might. And that's what really this is talking about. Not just the idolatry, but all of these treaties that they would want to make with these surrounding nations, rather than trusting in God, but they wanted to make treaties with these nations so they could share in that wealth and share in their lifestyle. Not just the idol worship itself, but all that's involved with that. But let me just kind of show you some things here. I mean, historically, when you just look at this, this is the Stele of Shalmaneser III, one of the great Assyrian kings. You'll notice that in the text, he is specifically talking about how the northern kingdom, Aholah, she lusted after the Assyrians. Okay, during this period of time, during the 9th and 8th centuries B.C., Assyria is the major power in the ancient world. And it's interesting when you just look at Shalmaneser III, and I show you this just to introduce him, and also just to make the point that, by the way, in this stela, he talks about having conquered a coalition of Levant nations, including Ahab of Israel, the King Ahab that you are familiar with from the Old Testament. But let me just show you this, and I've showed you this before, but let me show you this in light of this chapter in Ezekiel. Here's the obelisk of Shalmaneser III. It's about 9 feet tall, and it's this obelisk with all of those reliefs there that are all showing various nations sending their kings and their dignitaries to pay homage and tribute to the Assyrian king, Shalmaneser. And do you remember this plate here? I'll give you a close-up of that. This plate here is showing Shalmaneser III with all of his officials. And then here are all these Israelite officials. And here you have a kneeling figure who's especially paying homage to Shalmaneser III. Anyone recall who that kneeling figure is? Who was the king of Israel who defeated the Ahab dynasty, wiped it out per God's command, and eradicated Baalism from Israel? Anyone recall who he was? A little short name, you know. I hear several people whispering, Jehu, would you not come? Yes, it's Jehu. Yes. Jehu, the king of Israel, and if you recall what the book of Kings says, Jehu, after he wiped out the Ahab dynasty and wiped out all the prophets and priests of Baal, instead of continuing to serve Yahweh, what did he do? He went back and worshiped Yahweh how? Okay, resetting up those worship cultic sites at Dan and Bethel that actually Jeroboam the First had set up when the kingdom first divided. Okay? So in other words, he goes back to the false, perverted form of Yahweh worship, the paganistic form of Yahweh worship. Not Mosaic Judaism, but a perverted offshoot of that. Okay, but the reason why I'm showing you this is this is Shalmaneser depicting Jehu, king of Samaria, king of Israel, in other words, Aholah, doing exactly what this oracle in Ezekiel 23 is talking about. Lusting after the Assyrians and their power, paying tribute to them, bowing down before them in order to elicit their help. Okay, that's what all of this is about. And it's about getting in the good graces of the Assyrians so we can be in league with them and be part of this international world picture. Okay? That's what this oracle is talking about. And of course, in the oracle, like this wife now who goes off and plays the harlot, and she lusts after all of these men. What? I mean, even in our day, when you have a harlot, a prostitute, and here are all of these lovers, what eventually happens? Those lovers turn on her. That's why you see pictures of prostitutes, and they've been beaten up by the very men they've been having sex with. Because the whole point of that, it isn't a relationship with someone that really cares about you. It's someone who's just using you as a harlot for what they can get out of it. And that's the imagery here. Because that's exactly what happened with Israel. Israel just courted all the international treaties with Assyria. They wanted this relationship. That's what Jehu's doing here. And here, as you keep going on the relief on the obelisk, it's just depicting all of these Samaritan officials just bringing all this money and wealth and tribute. Remember back earlier when Ezekiel had talked about the harlotry of God's people, that they were a unique kind of harlot. They didn't receive pay, they gave pay. And that's what's going on here. That's what the prophet's talking about. And then another of these Assyrian kings later would be Tiglath-Pileser, and he ruled from 745 to 727. And, let me just make this point. Tiglath-Pileser is one that they appealed to and sought help from and all this. Do you recall, though, the history of Tiglath-Pileser and the Assyrians? What happened after toward the end of his reign and then following that? His successor is the very one that started the siege against Samaria. So think about what Ezekiel is talking about. He's saying that Aholah plays the harlot, and she lusts after these Assyrian lovers, and then they turn on her, and the very lovers she had, they're the ones that come and then devastate her. That's exactly what happened historically. Tiglath-Pileser, in 734, comes in with his armies, and he defeats the army of Aram and the army of Israel, the northern kingdom, and takes away a bunch of those northern citizens into Assyrian exile at that time. Okay? This is the very king and the very nation they've been making the treaties with. But of course, he doesn't care about them. It's just like a man going into a prostitute. He doesn't care about her. And what happens? They eventually turn on her when there's something that they don't like, and you hear stories of that. And that's the imagery that Ezekiel's using. It's a perfect analogy. And so then Sargon II, and he was the successor of Tiglath-Pileser, and in 721, the first year of his reign, he completes the siege of Samaria, and Samaria falls. Well, that's the very nation whose help they had sought. But that's the mistake that they made. Rather than trusting in Yahweh and going after these lovers, that's what happened. And I'll just show you this. This is the relief on the palace wall of Tiglath-Pileser. And this is not actually the siege of Samaria, but it's showing you the kind of siege and what they would do when they came into Samaria. In fact, there's a close-up of that. I mean, here's the palace wall, the fortification. Can everyone see what this is? That's a battering ram. That's the Assyrian battering ram. And they would just batter holes, breaches in those walls so they could finally, after a long siege where they just tired the people out, starved them out. And then they break through the walls. And, of course, you have the archers that are depicted here. And this is a significant thing. What would they do? Well, they would then slay all of those warriors in that city. They would strip them naked, which, by the way, he's going to use that same imagery in just a second. We will see that. He would strip them naked. They would impale their bodies and put them up on stakes, expose them to expose their nakedness. Why did they strip the bodies naked? One reason why. To shame them. Okay? And then you got depictions here of them slicing the throats or probably even decapitating the heads. That's what Ezekiel's talking about. And so, you know, this is the point of this. Verse 9 starting. Therefore I gave her into the hand of her lovers, into the hand of the Assyrians, after whom she lusted. They uncovered her nakedness. They took her sons and her daughters, but they slew her with the sword. Thus she became a byword among women, and they executed judgments on her. And there, throughout this chapter, there's a play on the terminology, uncovered her nakedness. Because that's a euphemism for to have sex with. But yet there's also a play on that, and this is what Ezekiel goes on to talk about, is, yes, after having adulterous intercourse with her, so to speak, in other words, that's the metaphor for this international treaty and all of this, well, then, ultimately, Assyria, that lover, comes in and turns against them and then devastates them and uncovers their nakedness in a different way. Uncovers their nakedness by slaying all of them, and now you have their naked bodies exposed like the Assyrians would do. So that's what Ezekiel's talking about. Does everyone see the power of that imagery? Okay. All right, comments about that down through verse 10? All right. Let me see here. Let's go back to 11. All right, now in verse 11, he turns to the younger sister, Aholibah, who represents Jerusalem. Now her sister, Aholibah, saw this. Yet, she was more corrupt in her lust than she. And her harlotries were more than the harlotries of her sister. She lusted after the Assyrians, governors and officials, the ones near, magnificently dressed, horsemen riding on horses, all of them desirable young men. And I saw that she had defiled herself. They both took the same way. So she increased her harlotries, and she saw men portrayed on the wall, images of the Chaldeans portrayed with vermilion. That's red, rich red color. Girded with belts on their loins and flowing turbans on their heads, all of them looking like officers, like the Babylonians in Chaldea, the land of their birth. And when she saw them, she lusted after them and sent messengers to them in Chaldea. And the Babylonians came to her, to the bed of love. And they defiled her with their harlotry. And when she had been defiled by them, she became disgusted with them. And she uncovered her harlotries and uncovered her nakedness. Then I became disgusted with her, as I had become disgusted with her sister. Yet she multiplied her harlotries, remembering the days of her youth when she played the harlot in the land of Egypt. And she lusted after their paramours, whose flesh is like the flesh of donkeys, and whose issue is like the issue of horses. Thus you longed for the lewdness of your youth when the Egyptians handled your bosom because of the breasts of your youth. Therefore, O Aholibah, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will arouse your lovers against you from whom you were alienated, and I will bring them against you from every side, the Babylonians and all the Chaldeans, Pekod and Shoah and Koah, and all the Assyrians with them, desirable young men, governors and officials, all of them, officers and men of renown, all of them riding on horses. And they will come against you with weapons, chariots and wagons, and with a company of peoples. They will set themselves against you on every side with buckler and shield and helmet. And I shall commit the judgment to them, and they will judge you according to their customs. And I will set my jealousy against you, that they may deal with you in wrath. They will remove your nose and your ears, and your survivors will fall by the sword. They will take your sons and your daughters, and your survivors will be consumed by the fire. They will also strip you of your clothes and take away your beautiful jewels. Thus I shall make your lewdness and your harlotry brought from the land of Egypt to cease from you, so that you will not lift up your eyes to them or remember Egypt anymore. For thus says the Lord God, behold, I will give you into the hand of those whom you hate, into the hand of those from whom you were alienated. And they will deal with you in hatred, take all your property, and leave you naked and bare. And the nakedness of your harlotry shall be uncovered, both your lewdness and your harlotry. Okay, let me just pause there and let's just kind of look at some things here. It really is just astounding when you think about the southern kingdom of Judah. They had the northern kingdom, their sister nation, as an example. As an example of failed policies. The idea of forsaking Yahweh and going after the world, and failed political policies, going after the Assyrians, going after the Babylonians, after them. I mean, all of that was an utter failure, and yet that's exactly what Judah replicated. Exactly. And then it ultimately turned out exactly the same. And that's what God is saying. It is going to turn out just the same. That then these very lovers that you've gone after, they will come and afflict you and devastate your land. Let me just talk about Tiglath-Pileser, because I mean you see this with the southern kingdom. 2 Kings 16 talks about King Ahaz of Judah. Okay, one of the worst kings that Judah ever knew. Just if there was ever a king that was idolatrous and that wanted to be a worldly ruler, to be just like the world, it was Ahaz. And 2 Kings 16 says, then Rezin, king of Aram, recovered Elath for Aram and cleared the Judeans out of Elath entirely. Those were territories that belonged to Ahaz and Judah. And so what does Ahaz do? Verse 7, so Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and deliver me from the hand of the king of Aram and from the hand of the king of Israel, who are rising up against me. Think about the language that he uses there, by the way. All right, here is Ahaz, the king of Judah, and he says to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, I am your servant and your son. What's ironic about that? Tragically so. That's exactly the language that God had used to talk about the relationship that he had with the seed of David. With the seed of David, those Davidic kings were the royal son of Yahweh, and they were the servant of Yahweh. And here Ahaz, he's just renouncing that. And it's just exactly what Ezekiel 23 is describing. He's appealing here to Tiglath-Pileser, and again, this is Assyria. That's the world power. They have all the might, and that's where Ahaz thought his salvation would come from. And he's appealing to Tiglath-Pileser to come in and to defeat Aram and to defeat Israel so that Judah will not have to worry about them. And it seemed like a real good plan. And by the way, I don't have time to go into all this, but Isaiah at the time was the prophet, and he's telling Ahaz, don't do it. Trust in Yahweh, not in these human kings. Ahaz wouldn't listen. Okay, what happened? In 734, that's when Tiglath-Pileser, he came in, and yes, he did wipe out Aram. He defeated Aram, defeated Israel, that little coalition army, so that Judah was supposedly saved. But does anyone recall what he did 2 years later? He came back in, and he took the northern portion of the southern kingdom into Assyrian exile. The northern portion of Judah goes into Assyrian exile in 732. People sometimes don't realize that. We think of the southern kingdom going into Babylonian exile. The northern portion of the southern kingdom, they went into Assyrian exile in 732. And that's what Tiglath-Pileser did. Well, but wait a minute. I appealed to you, and we gave you tribute money, and you said you'd help us. Yeah, he sure did. And after just raping that nation, yeah, to use the imagery that is being used here, what did he do? He just came on further and just took everything in the northern portion of the southern kingdom of Judah. So here the lover that you were lusting after turned on you. And that's what happened to your sister in the north, but here the southern kingdom making the very same mistake. I've showed you this before. This is the prism of Sennacherib talking about what he did in 701. Okay? Just a few years later, 701, Sennacherib, who's the successor of Sargon, he comes in and he just goes on a rampage and just rapes and pillages all throughout Judah and 48 of the strong cities of Judah. He destroys, for 46 rather. This is his inscription where he describes this military campaign throughout the Judean territory. As for Hezekiah the Jew, who did not submit to my yoke, 46 of his strong walled cities as well as the smaller cities in the neighborhood, I besieged and took himself like a caged bird. I shut up in Jerusalem, his royal city. But Hezekiah's grandfather had been appealing to the Assyrians for protection and for help. Yeah. But ultimately, this is what happened. Here's Hezekiah seeing the Assyrians turn on him. And that's what Ezekiel's talking about. Let me show you this. Merodach-Baladan, he was the king of Babylon. This is before the time of Nebuchadnezzar. This is still the time when Assyria is the dominant power in the ancient world. But Merodach-Baladan is the Babylonian king from 721 to 712. And Isaiah 39 talks about this. After Hezekiah had his illness and God healed him of that illness, here's what the text says. At that time, Merodach-Baladan, son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that he had been sick and had recovered. Now look at what Hezekiah does. And look at how Hezekiah is thinking. Now Hezekiah is a faithful king of Yahweh. But yet, look at the mistake that he makes. Hezekiah is thinking Assyria is my problem. And here's a Babylonian king who doesn't like Assyria either. And yet the Babylonian king sends him a nice friendly letter saying, hey, heard you were sick, glad you're better. Verse 2 says, Hezekiah was pleased and showed them, that is these emissaries from Babylon, showed them all his treasure house, the silver and the gold and the spices and the precious oil and his whole armory and all that was found in his treasuries. There was nothing in his house nor in all his dominion that Hezekiah did not show them. Why would Hezekiah have done that? What was his purpose? Hey, you're a powerful nation. We're a rich, powerful nation. He's trying to show, at least they weren't too powerful, but at least they had a lot of wealth. It kind of went all the way back to Solomon's day. We've still got that in our storehouses. Let me show you. He shows them all that. So, hey, we would be a good alliance here. And we together can kind of ward off the Assyrians and help each other. And you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. And this will be great. That's what Hezekiah is thinking. Now, he's not engaging in idolatry. I'm not trying to suggest that Hezekiah was doing exactly what Ahaz was doing. But what I am saying is there is something of the same attitude here. And Isaiah, the prophet, comes to Hezekiah and he says, hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and all that your fathers have laid up in store to this day will be carried to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord. And some of your sons who will issue from you, whom you will beget, will be taken away and they will become officials in the palace of the king of Babylon. Well, that's exactly what happened. The ironic thing to me is Hezekiah's attitude. When Isaiah tells him this, does anyone recall Hezekiah's response? He took it as at least good news that it wasn't going to happen in his lifetime. Which, you know, it's bewildered me. But that's the deal. And I'll just show you this. In several places in these verses that we've just read, he talked about how you lusted after their soldiers and on their palace walls, their soldiers with all their military garments and their weaponry and their belts and their buckles and all of this and their grand uniforms, all that on the palace walls. Okay, this is not a Babylonian palace wall. This is actually a Persian palace wall of Darius I after the Persians had defeated Babylonia. But you get the idea. I mean, this is what Ezekiel's talking about. And I'm sorry, just for sake of time, let me just make some comments on some specific verses. Because this is the point that he's making, is that you lust after these human armies and all their wealth and power, and it's going to come back and haunt you, just like it happened to Samaria. He says, verse 20, verse 19, yet she multiplied her harlotries, remembering the days of her youth when she played the harlot in the land of Egypt. And of course, all this time, and we've talked about this previously, what Judah kept trying to do was to make a coalition with Egypt. Egypt would hopefully be able to help them defeat the Babylonians and protect them from the Babylonians. And so what would they do? That they would engage in all the idolatry and all the worldliness of the Egyptians, just like they had done with the Babylonians. He says in verse 20, she lusted after their paramours, whose flesh is like the flesh of donkeys and whose issue is like the issue of horses. By the way, that means exactly what you think it means. I mean, that was a symbol of power, genitalia, and seed and progeny. That was a sign of power and wealth. That's the imagery. And he's getting pretty graphic, but that's the point that he's making. That's what you were looking at. And Egypt had all of that, you thought. By the way, when you, I can't help but think he's not alluding to this. I'm not going to show you any pictures of this. But a lot of the Egyptian iconography, phallic symbols, are just standard on the Egyptian temples in the Egyptian language. And a lot of the kings are depicted in that state to symbolize their power. I can't help but think that's not what he's alluding to. That you lusted after them because they are large of flesh and have the flesh of donkeys and all of that. Verse 21, thus you long for the lewdness of your youth when the Egyptians handled your bosom because of the breasts of your youth. Look at that graphic imagery. But his point is, that's really exactly what you people of Judah have been doing. You've been forsaking me, your spiritual husband, and you've gone after various lovers, and you're always trying some new lover, and it always turns on you. And that would happen still. Egypt would betray Judah, would not be able to help them against the Babylonians, and Babylon would ultimately come in and would devastate them. And we'll talk more about that in the next several days as we look at these oracles of Ezekiel right at the time when the siege of Jerusalem begins, that final siege that would bring about her fall. Okay? All right. Comments. Jim? Righteous jealousy.
Does this whole scenario reflect the same thing? Or
sure.
Using it as
sure. Righteous jealousy, for just like a husband is properly jealous for his wife, she's his wife, not some other man's. And that's a righteous
fighting,
kind of jealousy.
He's not fighting the other nations. He's using them. It seems like instead of going to war for Israel's sake, he's turned the other nations against Israel. But
he is allowing these paramours that they've had, that they thought were going to be their salvation, he's allowing them to do what they would do naturally, eventually turn on Judah and wipe him out, which is what they wanted to do, and steal all of that Judean wealth that went back to Solomon's time. And so that's what he's talking about. I think so. I think so, and maybe just this final point. This is such a perfect lesson for us today because we as Christians, we like this world. We like what's out there in the world. We like that wealth, and we don't like the fact of not being part of that. We want to be part of that. You know, Judah, under that Mosaic law, was its own strange Mosaic culture. And not part of the international scene. They didn't like that. That's why they were lusting after all of these foreign powers. And we can be the same way. And it's just such a valuable lesson, I think, for us. Okay, thank you, folks.